You're listening to the Music Review Database podcast. Hello, this is Chris, and welcome to the third episode of the Music Review Database podcast, where we interview artists and throw some discussion at you through your speakers. I've got a bit of a treat for you today, as I have now become skilled enough in bothering PR agencies into submission and having them give me some alone time with the artists they represent. I managed to score an interview with accomplished producer, guitarist, composer, and head of Alpha Basic Music, Ben Jordan, also known as the Fleshbulb, among others. What you're about to hear are, as always, excerpts from the Skype session I did with him on October the 7th, where we spoke about his past, his musical influences, his upcoming live show, and his soon-to-be-released album. So, as always, I hope you're having fun listening to this. I surely had fun making this, and I'll see you on the other side. So, can you tell me a bit about your musical background?
I started playing guitar, mostly jazz influenced, when I was maybe... I probably started when I was five or something, and then, you know, I think I got, you know, as I grew older, I got more and more serious about it. And started learning to play piano and drums and other instruments, and started recording probably when I was maybe 13 years old. And, yeah, and just, you know, as a project, and I was in a couple different bands and stuff like that, and ended up just doing more and more by myself over the years, and that eventually turned into what I do now.
Okay, and how would you describe your music to somebody who has never heard your music before?
It's always tough. it's always really hard, because it's, you know, usually anything that I would have to compare it to, the person hasn't heard of either, so... And it's also really hard because, you know, if I tell somebody, oh, it's like the soft cinematic stuff, then they might go find like some really more abrasive experimental stuff. Or, you know, if I tell them it's experimental, then they'll like go find something like Louisiana Morning or, you know, something that's like very, very tame. And so, usually if somebody asks me what I do for a living, I just, you know, tell them I make music for television or something. Just try and bypass that whole question, just because there's no real, you know, I just tell them I do whatever I want, I guess. yeah, that's because, you know, I guess I don't really fit into any genre.
Well, yeah, that's what amazes me as well about your career, because it's so varied. You've done music for expositions, you're doing commercials. I saw the commercial that you did for Dove, mm-hmm. and it was really, really well done.
Yeah, it's a really good, that was a really good ad campaign, and, you know, super popular. I mean, I think it was, I don't know what the stats are, but now, but, you know, at the time it was the most seen advertisement, and it won Cannes Film Festival awards, won two of those. Like won every ad award you could win that year. It was a really successful campaign, so...
That must have been a really amazing experience, and I would imagine that it really put you as an artist on the map, as it were.
Yeah, it definitely put me on the map, and it definitely put the agency, Vapor Music Group, that I was working with for that ad. It definitely put them on the map and grew that company, which in turn, you know, led to better, you know, better quality and more work for me and the other composers that work with the company. So it was pretty great in that sense.
The record label that you're on, Alpha Basic, is your label, if I recall correctly. Am I right?
Yes. Yeah.
And what made you decide to start an independent company to release your music on?
In 2001, I started it with two other partners. And the idea of it is kind of funny, in that when we first started it, the idea was, you know, we were doing all these, the party, I don't even want to say party, but just the electronic music scene was really rich in Chicago at the time. And we would always be asked for vinyl merch. And instead of branding it, we would just sell white label records with no name on it or anything. And some of it was my music, some of it was my friend's music, you know, stuff like that. And a lot of it was like Acid Wolf type stuff. And we would, yeah, and so we would do like short runs of these records and just sell them there. And Alpha Basic would be the only thing that's set on the record. And then as time progressed, if I had an alias that, you know, that a label didn't like, or, you know, because I was releasing on Sublight or Suburban Trash or these other record labels. And when I was doing that, it was, you know, I wasn't allowed to release a Flashbulb CD with a different label because that label was currently, you know, releasing the Flashbulb or something like that. So I would go with a different alias somewhere else. And so Alpha Basic just sort of gave me, initially, it just gave me freedom to release whatever I wanted. and then, you know, once music piracy and digital music kind of just got, you know, got completely mainstream, it became less and less desirable to be on a normal record label, to split your income with somebody else. And you know, another thing that frustrated me is I'd finish an album and it would, you know, it'd be a year backup before it could be released. With bigger labels like Warp Records, you know, they showed interest in releasing my stuff, you know, almost a decade ago, but there would be, you know, a year and a half to 2 years before it would come out. And that's, you know, and that's a year and a half to 2 years where I'm just like sitting and don't have any releases. And so it always seemed really pointless to work with a record label when I could just do it myself. And now Alpha Basic has branched out to a much, much larger, you know, bigger thing. So that's really great.
Yeah, you basically touched upon a few questions I was meaning to ask you later in the conversation, but you intentionally leak your own stuff, don't you?
Yeah. I usually do it to What CD and Waffle and stuff. Yeah,
this is funny because I'm actually a registered user on that site, and it was through that site that I first came into contact with your music. And,
oh, cool.
Yeah, and I always read the note that you include in the download folder, and it has made me donate in the past, which is a good thing. So you could say that this business model is really working out for you.
Yeah, it's you know, and it wasn't even a plan at the time. Like it wasn't, you know, I didn't expect it to even turn into a business model. I was, you know, the first time I did it, I was just like, well, it's going to be up here in 20 minutes, you know, so it's going to be up here the minute somebody gets their CD in the mail, and that person might not rip it correctly. That person might, you know, that it doesn't have any sort of information in it that would give it to, that would lead the person to find more music from me. And more importantly, I never want to think of people as criminals for listening to my music. I just think that's silly. So yeah, I wanted to make that clear in that note that, you know, I don't really, that I appreciate anyone listening to my music, and I don't expect people who collect their music digitally to, you know, cross some sort of barrier and buy CDs. You know, that's just silly. I'm really happy that as many people listen to my music that do. So.
Yeah, I feel that I'm really lucky because I live in the Netherlands and our laws are quite liberal. If I download something over here, it's no problem. But if I would bring my music collection over to the US, I would be in really, really big trouble.
Yeah, it's interesting. It seems like all those cases you hear about where people are being sued for all this money and fought with this and that. I don't know anyone personally who has ever dealt with that. Not even a fan of mine or anything like that. Nobody's ever come to me with that. I've gotten letters myself from my internet service provider. You know, basically you get a letter that like says, it's usually if you download something really mainstream, you know, if you download like a newer movie or something like that, and I'll get a letter basically threatening me or something, and I usually just crumble it up and throw it in the garbage. But
yeah, I've heard about those.
Yeah, I mean, you know, everybody gets them and we're all just like, okay, you know, it's ridiculous because if it actually went into the court of law, you can't really prove that somebody, you know, but with you have Wi-Fi networks and you have you know, your IP changes every day, and it's so funny because you can't really prove in the court of law that somebody downloaded something. So usually what in these cases that you hear about, they usually just basically try to get the person to admit to it and confess to it, and then they, you know, bring the charges on and, like, you know, charge them $200 for sharing an album, you know, or something like that. $200,000 for sharing an album that, you know, it's a lot better than it is in Japan, for example, where I believe they have mandatory sentencing now for downloading and sharing, which is insane to me.
Yeah, it is insane. You can't really stop it. And I think it's a waste of everybody's time to try and persecute these people who just download some random data of the internet because they want to listen to music.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I mean, it's interesting just how long it took the industry. When I look at a company like Netflix, for example, like they've, you know, so like as of 4 years ago, Netflix streaming had a vast library. It's even better now, of course, but they had a vast library. Most of my friends were using it as their primary source of watching movies. The movie companies were making money. People were happy to pay, you know, $10 a month to have this bank of movies that they could stream whenever they wanted. And it was hilarious to me how Netflix had figured this out. And it's so much harder to stream video, and that industry is so much more closed off than the music industry. And yet no company at that time had, you know, the RIAA hadn't figured out yet how to maximize on the technology that we have now. And now you have Spotify, which is great. You know, Spotify's, I really support that. I'm happy with that because it's probably the only streaming service that I actually get a good amount of money from every couple months, where I'm like, oh, wow, they're actually paying me my fair share for people, you know, streaming my music on there. And I'm very happy with it. You know, it's really great. And, you know, I use it in my car. I use it in, you know, I use it at home. I use Spotify all the time because it's actually a little bit simpler than downloading a bunch of files and, like, you know, putting them on my drive and organizing them and all that stuff. And so for casual music listenings, you know, Spotify seems to have figured it out. But I just can't believe that it took, you know, from the advent of Napster and when that whole thing broke out, I can't believe it took over a decade for one company to finally emerge and have a solution that beats, you know, getting music on torrents for the casual listener.
And let's move back to your music now. How do you approach the making of a new album? Do you just go into the studio with a specific idea, or do you just go in and grab an instrument or a synth and go from there?
It used to be a little more chaotic. I used to go in and just, you know, make whatever, and then when I had a big collection, I would put an album out. Now I seem to be a little bit more, you know, I want to be a little more theme-based, and it makes it a little more interesting that way. So, yeah, these days I usually have, you know, I have an idea, and I have an idea of how many tracks I'm going to end up wanting in the end. And, you know, for every track that winds up on the actual album, there's probably, you know, one or one and a half that doesn't end up on there. I'm really selective, but yeah, now it's a little more theme-based, and I try and, you know, orchestrate it as a finished product rather than just a compilation of random tracks like it used to be.
And a lot of your other projects, say Acid Wolf, for example, feature heavy use of the TB-303 and are, in their essence, acid music. But what draws you to this particular synth?
It's kind of always been the go-to synth for me. Simply growing up in South Chicago, that's where the whole scene kind of started. And it's kind of it's funny for people in other places to imagine this, but when I was a teenager, when I was a young teenager, acid music was played on the mainstream radio stations. You know, like you'd have gangbangers driving by with it bumping in their car. When you turned on TV late at night, it would literally be like acid dance parties on the less popular channels. They would have, like, you know, a dance party TV show, and it would just all be acid house. And also I should mention that, like, at where acid came from, it definitely didn't come from, like, the trance scene or the rave scene. It actually came from, like, a predominantly African-American dance scene. So it's really interesting because it kind of existed in these South Side neighborhoods, where you would never imagine like a modern electronic music to come out of, and that's sort of like where house and acid house came from in Chicago. And so when I was younger, that's all I heard, you know, that was electronic music to me. It was acid, and most of it was horrible. We have our classics now that we think back to, but like most of it at the time was super obnoxious and terrible, you know, and it seems like the filter of time has kept some of the classics up and then forgotten the rest, thank God. But yeah, most of it was just terrible. But you had your gems, and so that just sort of naturally became an influence, I think.
Well, it's the same with Gabba music over here. It's widely regarded as an important music genre for Dutch electronic mm-hmm. music. But if you look back to the time when it was really, really popular, it was absolute rubbish. A lot of people will hate me for saying that, but it was.
Well, yeah, I mean, anytime you have a genre that's blowing up somewhere, or, you had dubstep last year, and now you have, whatever the new thing is. And whenever you have a genre, it's like you have amazing things. You could always find an amazing thing in that genre, but it seems like when people make music to specifically fit into that explosion, you just have so much crap coming out of it. And so, you have amazing dubstep out there. There's absolutely incredible stuff. And then there's stuff like Burial and stuff that kind of like crosses into that genre that's just brilliant. But for every amazing track you have, or every amazing artist you have, a thousand that are just sort of jumping on the train, and they're not really making what they want to make, and it's, it just sounds unnatural and generic.
Yeah. Is dubstep still a thing over in the US, or is that over now?
It depends. Things seem to sort of like, you have cities like New York and Chicago and Vancouver, I think, are usually the scenes that are kind of the hippest or whatever. So dubstep was pretty popular like 5 years ago. It started coming in, and now it's kind of old. And now it's kind of funny because last summer when I was on tour, I'd be in the middle of nowhere in Montana or something, and I remember I was walking from like a gas station to like, a sandwich shop or something like that, like way out in the mountains, and there was these kids smoking meth. In this like beat up car and just blasting dubstep, and I was just like, okay, well, this is dubstep had reached its farthest. it had gone all the way down to the bottom of the root, and so it officially can't be cool anymore if people are like smoking meth and watching NASCAR and listening to dubstep. So
well, I'm on the outside looking in, of course, but NASCAR is really regarded as a bad thing over there.
It depends, I mean, it's considered it's a thing that's enjoyed much more in rural environments. Like people, nobody in Chicago watches NASCAR, but people in Southern Illinois, like 4 hours from Chicago, everybody's, completely hooked on NASCAR. So it's just like a sport that just seems to be more kind of like a hillbilly type sport. So it's very funny. So for dubstep and NASCAR to be in the same in the same thing, if you have somebody with a NASCAR shirt on listening to dubstep, you're just like, wow, okay. So
it's basically two pointless and repetitive things together at last.
yeah, that it doesn't make sense, but it makes perfect sense. So it's just sort of
your music, Ash the Flashbulb, has seen a remarkable change over the years. From glitch and straight up IDM to a more glitchy sort of down tempo. What made you change from an established sound, and what was the reaction from your established fan base?
I guess I got really bored with making music that was as edgy as it was. If that makes any sense, you would think it'd be hard to get bored, but I got really bored with that, and I got really interested in making melodies and more picturesque music that would stand a little bit, that would be a little more timeless, I guess. That's the best way I could describe it. Like I didn't really want to be on any sort of niche or using any sort of technique that you know is based on the technology. I would so I was more interested in just composing something and working on the atmosphere. And it's interesting because I mean in the most in the craziest, most glitched out track, I probably spent more time on just like a piano track with a little atmosphere, you know, because I'm just like I'm going just as deep, but it's just not as abrasive. But you know, of course, you have your fans who are, you know, disappointed, and then I get a lot of fans too, who now my next release is actually pretty abrasive again, and it's, you know, it's sort of back into the DSP world, and you know, who knows, you know, I'm sure a lot of people will be disappointed, I'm sure a lot of people will be happy, so.
And speaking of your fans, you've got a lot of different fans around the world nowadays, and I'm just wondering, how does it make you feel to be that well known to people from all walks of life?
One thing I really like about it, one thing that makes me really happy is that when I play a show somewhere, the audience is never one type of people, you know, it's never a bunch of ravers, or it's never a bunch of hipsters, or it's never a bunch of, you know, it's really a mixed group. And that's one really awesome redeeming quality of it is, yeah. When I, you know, if I go out and meet an audience, I meet so many different people from so many different walks of life, all sort of coming to the same venue. And that I think is really cool. That's really unique, and it's really hard to find that these days, because usually you have your scene, you know, you have a music that fits into a scene, and then the people in that scene go to the show, and it's really prescribed and stuff. Right? Yeah. I believe that a lot of it comes from just not really marketing myself at all, and just making albums and letting word of mouth be my best promotion campaign. And so, yeah, that sort of led to it not being seen involved. And so it's nice in that sense. But I usually just don't think about it unless I'm on tour and actually, you know, dealing with it on a daily basis. I usually just, you know, pretend that doesn't even exist and just try and concentrate on what I'm doing. Because I never want to think about what other people's ears are doing when they hear my stuff, because that's going to influence me to make something that sounds different, right? So I always want to make it selfishly and then let people decide later. So,
and when it comes to playing live and to doing tours, are you planning on visiting other continents as well, besides America?
Yeah, right now I'm actually working extensively on one show in Chicago, which I haven't played in Chicago in a while, and it's at the Adler Planetarium, and it utilizes this brand new $14 million screen that's it's like a 360 environment that you sit inside, and I'm working with a team of astronomers, and it's going to be, I mean, I can honestly say it's going to be the best music visuals in history. It's going to be absolutely incredible. So I've been working night and day on that, and coding all the visuals, and working with these astronomers of this massive bank of visual data. As far as other places, I do plan on coming back to Europe, and you know, doing a full tour. It's always been a matter of I want everything to line up properly, in terms of that, you know, I have these promoters throughout Europe that have been asking me for years to come play, and I want to make it to where all of them can, you know, while I'm there, to where all of them can do a show and it can be done right. Because another problem that most artists, electronic artists, don't face is gear. You know, they have like a laptop and a controller, whereas I have, you know, but when I play shows in America, I basically have a truck trailer filled with gear usually. So I don't use computers when I play live, so I have a ton of gear. And I want to bring that same experience to Europe. I don't want to cheapen it and, you know, and play with less gear or play a different type of set. So yeah, basically it's just been like waiting for all those things to combine and work out properly. Cause when I do it, I want to do it right. You know, I want it to be an incredible show. I don't want it to just be a quick flight over. So, yeah.
Let's talk about influences. If you are influenced by any other artists, who are they?
Lately in the last year, I don't think I have been, which is always sad. you know, for some reason I haven't been blown away by anything. But you know, I've been influenced by everything from, usually jazz is my number one influence when it comes to melody writing or structuring or something like that. Of course, you know, in the past I've been influenced by Aphex Twin and, you know, that the other artists in that warp, you know, like Squarepusher and Autechre and stuff like that. They're really hard not to be influenced by because they're all incredible musicians and incredible people. All over the place. But in terms of my biggest influences, I would say Buddy Rich, Vince Guaraldi, John Coltrane, of course. Like his writing style and structure style is always, you know, I feel like I've learned something new every time I listen to it. So that's hugely influential. So yeah.
And outside of people, what influences you?
I guess life in general, kind of. I just sort of, yeah. I don't, you know, I've been a musician for so long, and it's been my full-time job for so long that I guess, you know, instead of like having inspiration and all of a sudden going down and writing, you know, I'm writing music in one way or another all the time. And so it just, you know, if I'm having a bad day, then, you know, I guess I'll be more inspired to, you know, write something depressing or something. But, you know, and if I have a great day, then I'll be more inspired to write something. So it's really just so woven in with my daily life that it's hard to even figure out. The question I ask myself is not what influences me, but like, what doesn't influence me?
And let's dive a bit deeper into what I asked you earlier. What does jazz as a genre mean to you?
I have a pretty good explanation for it. It's because it gets so skewed when you think of Kenny G and all these other, you know, like when you think of smooth jazz and like Kenny G and, you know, these artists that have kind of destroyed the genre and sort of turned something that was like edgy and incredible into what now people think of as like lame and for, you know, 50-year-old golfers. I truly believe that in 100, 200 years, people look at jazz as a natural evolution of classical music. Like, because most of the classical music you hear now, when it's dubbed as classical music, it sounds like classical music from 200 years ago. It's inspired by fugues and things like that. Whereas you had, the way jazz started, you have French classical music, which, you know, Debussy and Eric Satie and Ravel.
I love Satie.
Yeah, and it sounds, it really kind of sounds jazzy almost, you know, like they're starting to use suspended chords and they're starting to kind of push that boundary. And then as America, after the Civil War, you have this new music coming out of New Orleans, which, you know, now you have the same instruments that you have with classical music. You have your piano, you have your upright bass, but now instead of being bowed, it's being plucked. You know, you have these same instruments, but it's sounding a little bit different. And, you know, from like the Debussy and Satie sound, it's starting to sound a little bit, it's being modified a little bit. And you have a bunch of French immigrants and you have a bunch of slave descendants and people who were slaves playing this music. And so it's really interesting because it was sort of born in that area and then, like, you know, moved up to Chicago as blacks migrated to the north because of, you know, the crazy conditions in the south. And so I really think it's an extension, a natural evolution of classical music. But more importantly, I think it's America's genre. I think most people don't realize that is that it's really the genre of America. That it's American music, and it's and when I see people, you know, I always see these shows where there's like free jazz, where someone's, you know, plucking the strings off of a violin and making noise, and another guy who can't play the drums is just like hitting a snare and things like that. And that always infuriates me so much, because, you know, I'm like, you know, John Coltrane and Miles Davis, these people, they left their families to spend every night playing a show somewhere, or their entire adult lives. They did this to spread this American music that America made, you know, and that's what jazz is. It's not like, you know, something you pretend to like because your college music program is snotty or something, you know? And so, so to me, answer simplified, it's a short answer. It's an extension of classical music that is sort of turned into America's own genre.
And a major influence on you as well.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And you're very consistent, at least I think so. You're very consistent with releasing your music. Sometimes we get more than one album a year, you know?
Uh-huh.
And you're even so consistent that I recently said to a friend that everything can fall apart, but we can at least depend on another Flashbulb album coming out this year, you know?
Yeah.
And is it hard to keep to this seemingly tight schedule of producing an album and releasing it and producing and releasing it each year?
No, it's not. It's harder to deal with a record label that only lets you release one thing every 2 years because of marketing costs and stuff like that. That was harder. That was the difficult part. This is just naturally, I'm making music. I see something fit for release or I decide I'm going to make something that will hopefully be fit for release, and then I'll release it. And it's super simple, you know, and I'll finish an album, I'll master it, and then I'll be like, okay, let's put it for sale on Tuesday, you know? And it's like, it's that simple. It doesn't have any sort of politics or complicated negotiations with it, or, you know, how are we going to market this, and when's the best time to release it? None of that is ever an equation with me, so... Yeah, it's really easy and laid back.
It gives you a lot of freedom to just make something and put it out when it's finished and get it to your fans as fast as possible, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, really. Yeah. I mean, usually I'll finish an album and a month and a half later is its release. You know, we just like, as long as it takes to make the CDs and organize the pre-orders at the office and that stuff, then it's done. So, yeah.
These coming questions might be a bit hard, but... what is your favorite track in your catalog?
Ooh, that one's tough. it seems, you know, I usually would, I almost always want to say it's like the last one I made, you know, because that's the one I'm currently into. But when I think of like, there's some that pop out where I think to myself, wow, I don't think I could make that again, or I don't think I can make anything like that again. I think one is Interior South Dakota off of Reunion. There's a couple on Reunion. I think like my version of Summertime on Reunion was just sort of playing the piano and recording and not actually thinking that I would have anything down. And when I listened to it back, I was just very, very happy with the way it turned out. So I think it would be one of those two off of Reunion. Because Reunion, that album was made in a really interesting way in comparison to the other ones. It was kind of pushed into a month of production, and I didn't do it in my home studio. I did it in another studio where I just sort of spent 18 hours a day, you know, recording stuff to tape and doing that stuff. So that one has a lot of gems that, to me, that are gems that sort of pop out that I don't think I could do again. You know,
do you have the feeling that you're continuously pushing your own boundaries or the boundaries of your defined genre with every release?
Sometimes. I don't look at most people see this as a benefit. I see it as a problem. One problem that I see with IDM and that genre is people seem to look at music as if like it's, you know, cell phone technology or something. Like they sort of compare it to like a scientific process where everything has to be done in a way that has never been done before. and it always has to be original and it 100%, and you can't compare it to anything else, which I think is silly. I don't, you know, that's not making music. That's like, you know, that's not what I'm not in the business of inventing a new sound every time I make a song. I'm in the business of just writing music. And so, I try not to think that way. I'm sure, I'm positive that there's things I've done that have never been done before. And I'm positive that in the future that it'll be the same thing. But I don't look for that. I don't try and think of myself as an innovator, because, you know, that really kind of interrupts the process of making something that I would think would sound beautiful. You know, I'd be more obsessed with the production techniques. I'd be so obsessed with it that I would not be able to actually concentrate on making, you know, a track that sounds good to me that I would ever want to listen to again. So.
And your favorite album in your catalog, is it the same as with the last one, that you enjoy your most recently released one most, or?
I'm kind of sick of my last one now, or the one that's about to come out. I'm sick of it now because I, you know, I've been mastering it and testing it on speakers, so now I'm just kind of like, I don't want to hear it for a year. But I think I'd say Reunion again. I think that just because it was such a different technique of making stuff, and it's all very different than anything else I've done in style of production, and so that one always sort of holds its special place for me. But oddly enough, people, you know, that's not my most liked album by far. You know, it had very mixed reviews.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but you recently said that you were going to release an EP, but I looked up the track list and it's quite long. So what is it? Is it an album or is it an EP?
It's an album. Most people, it's funny because, you know, some of my albums have, you know, 30 tracks on it. So when I think of an EP, I think, like, when I think of EP, I guess, like, yeah, 11 or 12 tracks to me is an EP. But, this one has, for some reason, I can't think if it has 11 or 12 tracks. But, it has, like, 11 or 12 tracks, and I think 11. So technically, it's an album. You know, it plays out to, like, 45 or 50 minutes or something. The tracks are longer than usual with my music.
Your latest album is, of course, Opus at the End of Everything.
Uh-huh.
Could you tell me a bit more about the album?
That one, I spent a good amount of time on that one, and I put a lot of work into it in terms of production, and, you know, I would say I probably wrote 3 albums worth of music and sort of cut it all down to that. It uses a lot of tape. It uses a lot of, like, degraded audio that was kind of purposely degraded, and so a lot of things are more organic than usual. And I was really interested in creating a story that went from beginning to end, and everything kind of fit together. And that was really that was really the number one goal of that, is to fit everything together in this album, which, you know, sometimes is good, sometimes is bad. It's bad for somebody who, like, buys single tracks off iTunes, but it's good for somebody who listens to the whole thing in succession. So,
yeah, the album in itself sounds very, very cohesive, and and it reminds me a lot of Soundtrack to a Vacant Life in terms of flow and direction, you know.
Yeah, it is similar in that sense. Yeah. It might be a little more cohesive, actually, I think.
Tracks flow into each other a lot more.
Soundtrack to a Vacant Life, I worked really hard to bundle them together to flow into each other, whereas Opus at the End of Everything, I sort of wrote them to flow into each other. So, yeah, it's...
Regarding your live performance,
uh-huh.
As somebody who has never been to a Fleshbulb concert, could you describe to me what a concert of the Fleshbulb is like?
I do a lot of improvised guitar stuff. I have MIDI pickups on my guitar that I control, you know, a million and one things with. And I use a lot of looping and stuff like that. So usually half of my set will be music that I'm sort of writing on the spot, and then half of my set will be music that the audience would be familiar with from my albums. So I try and split it up halfway between the two. But depending on the audience, if the audience seems more into a musical performance, or if it's a sit down audience, I'll work a little harder at the improvising and the performing guitar thing. And if the audience, if I'm playing at like Bang Face or some sort of thing like that, where the audience is just kind of wanting to hear the classics that they or classics to them, then I'll concentrate more on that. But I really like not having a set planned out and not having a computer and just being able to read the audience and sort of play whatever I'm in the mood to play. That's a pretty unique thing that I worked 10 years or so to achieve.
Which to me is very refreshing, because of a lot of electronic artists usually just bring a laptop and play their songs from their from their laptop. But you actually do a lot more to achieve your sound than most other artists nowadays.
Yeah, admittedly, I hate to admit it, but admittedly, I hate going to electronic shows under almost all circumstances. Like there's nothing more boring to me. I just, it's basically, if somebody brings me to an electronic show or something like that, I'm just like, cool, well, it looks like I'll be searching for some new apps on my phone while I'm there, and it just, because, yeah, I don't know, I'm just immensely bored by lack of performance, by real performance, and I think that's just because I come from like a jazz background where, performance is everything, and it's very masturbatory with instruments and stuff, whereas, just seeing somebody work on a laptop, I just can't handle it. I get very bored very fast. So I just really want to avoid being that artist, even though, but I'm, other people seem to have an okay time watching a laptop artist. But for me, I would probably be bored playing a show that way too. So.
Well, it seems we've burned through my questions, because you answered most of my questions even without me asking them.
Yeah.
So in that regard, you've actually been awesome. The perfect interviewee.
Yeah. Awesome.
Well, is there anything you would like to add? Would you like to say something to our listeners, our readers, and of course your dear fans?
No, that's about it. Yeah, check out the new album and stay off hard drugs. That don't. Laugh about Mitt Romney. I apologize. I apologize for how ridiculous our politics are here. Just laugh at them. So,
this is my least favorite part of an interview, and this is me saying goodbye. And thank you so much for your time, and thank you for this enlightening conversation. And maybe we'll speak again in the future. And have a great day.
Okay. You too. Take care.